By the time I began my senior year in high school, I knew I wanted to go to college and be a musician of some kind. I couldn't see myself hanging around Wilmington working at a 7-Eleven, gigging in a pop band that played the VFW and other seedy country joints, which is what I was doing. I did have an urge to stay out of school and study saxophone and jazz composition like the old-timers I admired, Byrd, Coltrane, Clifford Brown, but I was afraid I might never get out of Delaware. Ma wanted me out of Delaware, too, but she had no escape. She was the unhappiest I had ever seen her. It was like her legs were cut out from under her. The day before Thanksgiving in 1974, her old Toyota broke down and she had no money to fix it, which meant that we had to take a bus to some godforsaken distant supermarket to find a turkey we could afford. We found the Byrd, but when we got on the bus to go home, the paper bag holding the frozen turkey burst. It fell out of the bag and rolled all the way down the aisle to the front of the bus where the driver grabbed it. The passengers and driver laughed, but to Ma, this episode epitomized her entire experience in Delaware, that darned turkey rolling down the darned aisle in front of all those darned people. She had few friends here. The black folks found her to be awkward, the white folks bored her, but there was no quick and easy escape. College was my way out. My eldest brother's wife, Becky, had gone to Oberlin College in Ohio, and she told me I should apply because they had a great liberal arts school, a conservatory of music, and most of all, scholarship money. My high school grades were sour, my SATs low, but my musical and writing abilities were strong, and I had good recommendations. To my utter amazement, the school accepted me. Mommy was completely happy when I told her the news. She hugged me and beamed, put the acceptance letter in her shoebox under her bed, and bragged to anyone she saw in the supermarkets, at the library, "My son's going to Oberlin. You ever heard of Oberlin? Oh, let me tell you." I was the 8th straight child she sent to college. The 7 before me all graduated, and most went on for higher degrees. On a cloudy, rainy day in September 1975, I packed everything I owned into an old green duffel bag, and Ma drove me to the Greyhound bus station. As usual, she was broke, dumping single-dollar bills, change, pennies on the counter to pay for the one-way ticket to Ohio. As I stepped on the bus, she squeezed a bunch of bills and change into my hand. "It's all I have," she said. I counted it. $14. "Thanks, Ma." I kissed her and got on the bus quickly to hide my own tears. I felt I was abandoning her. She hated Delaware, and I had talked her into staying there, and now I was leaving. Yet she wanted me to go. As I sat down on the bus and looked for her through the window, it occurred to me that since I was a little boy, she had always wanted me to go. She was always sending me off on a bus someplace, to elementary school, to camp, to relatives in Kentucky, to college. She pushed me away from her just as she'd pushed my elder siblings away when we lived in New York, literally shoving them out of the front door when they left for college. She would not hear of it when they applied to schools that were near home. "If you stay here, you'll fool around," she said. "Go away and learn to live on your own." Yet she'd wipe her eyes with the back of her hand and watch silently through the living room window as they smiled and waved goodbye from the sidewalk, straining under the weight of the same cheap duffel bag that now lay in the belly of the Greyhound bus holding my things. She always cried when they left, though never in front of us. She'd retreat to her room for that. I was actually worried she would cry when I boarded the bus, but when I looked at her through the window, I was relieved to see she wasn't crying at all. She was pacing, puckering her lips, frowning, making faces. She paced this way and that, hands in her pocket, as the wind blew swirls of leaves and discarded paper cups about her feet. She was wearing a brown raincoat and a scarf over her head. A lone white woman marching back and forth on a dim street in front of the dilapidated bus station in Wilmington, Delaware, beneath a rumbling Amtrak train trestle and a cloudy sky. She seemed so agitated and jumpy, I remember wondering if she had to go to the bathroom. As the bus engine rumbled to life, she didn't wave, but rather gave a quick flip of the hand that said, "Go, go on," and hurried away. The bus pulled off, and she was out of sight for a moment. But after we turned the corner, I saw her from the window across the aisle, and she had broken down. She was leaning on the wall beneath the train trestle, head bowed, one hand squeezing her eyes as if the tears that flowed out of them could be squeezed into oblivion.
The promise. After my adventures with Rocky, I was done with the fast life. I got a job at a diner serving food to customers, and after a couple of weeks, Dennis called on me again, and we started going out. He was a real serious man, thoughtful and solid, different from Rocky and the other men I had seen in Harlem who hung around Small's Paradise. Dennis was a violinist who had come to New York from High Point, North Carolina. He came to New York in his middle 20s, which was a late age for most folks to leave home in those days. But he was an only child, and his mother, Etta, didn't want him to leave home. She had a few miscarriages, and Dennis was her only son. But he went to New York because he wanted to pursue music. He played violin and read music and composed it, mostly classical and religious music. Your father came from the same town and went to the same high school as John Coltrane. But he was ahead of Coltrane in age. Dennis used to sit around with stacks of sheet music when I first met him, scribbling at it and scoring it out. He played the violin beautifully, and I'd often ask him to play various songs for me. He also was a good singer and sang in the Metropolitan Baptist Church Choir in Harlem. Dennis almost starved to death fooling around with that music, which is why I never wanted you fooling around with it when you decided to make a living at it. They wouldn't hire a black man for the orchestras or anything like that in those days, and he scuffled around and slept in flop houses. What saved him was some friends from his hometown at High Point, Curtis and Minnie Ware. Curtis worked as a superintendent in an apartment in Manhattan, and he and Minnie were well off compared to most black folks who came up from the South, because they lived rent-free. Curtis and Minnie housed and fed whole families that had migrated north from High Point, but Dennis was too proud to look them up. Only after he was starving and sleeping in the flop houses did he tell them, "I got no money and no place to go." And they were angry with him. They said, "You should have come to us sooner." They had four other friends and a sister from the South all crammed into their apartment. At mealtimes, there was a huge round table filled with all kinds of Southern cooking, baked goods, and cold drinks. After Dennis got on his feet and got a job at my Aunt May's leather factory and we started going out, he brought me by there and he said, "I want you all to meet a friend of mine." And their eyes kind of popped out when I walked into the room. This was around 1940, and black and white didn't do what me and Dennis were doing, walking around and such. Some folks did it, but it was all a secret, or they were good-time partying folks like Rocky's friends at Small's Paradise. But Dennis was a Christian man and a serious man, and so were his friends. This was no joking matter to them. But once they managed to pull their jaws from off the floor, they said, "Our house is your house. Sit down and eat." And I didn't have any problem with them or any of Dennis's family. They took me in with open hearts and made me one of their own. The only thing was it sometimes took a minute for them to get over the shock of seeing a black and white together. Like Aunt Candace, Dennis's aunt, Aunt Candace was Dennis's favorite. She was the grandchild of slaves. When I first came to North Carolina and walked into her house, she said, "I just hope you excuse me for looking at you so hard, but I've never had a white person in my house before, and I have never been this close to a white person before." And I said, "All right." And she was my friend till she died. I'll never forget her as long as I live. She lived to be nearly 100. We wouldn't have made it without Aunt Candace. She came up from North Carolina and cared for you all after Dennis died, because I was grieving and lost, and I couldn't move. I couldn't move. She took the train all the way up to New York from North Carolina and took care of all eight of you, including you, James, and you weren't but a tiny child. She'd never been to the city before. She'd never seen so much cement and so many tall buildings in her life. Your stepfather, he bought her a big gold watch after he married me, and she left to go home to North Carolina. He said, "That's some woman." And he was right. She was some woman. Well, Dennis was a solid, clean Christian man. He seemed to understand me and see right through me, and it wasn't long before I fell in love with him. And after a few months, we started thinking of getting married. Well, I was thinking of getting married. Dennis hemmed and hawed on it, and finally he said, "Let's live together as husband and wife. We don't need the world to know we're married. The world isn't ready for us yet." That excuse was okay for me, for the time being. So we rented a room at the Port Royal on 129th Street. We had a room in a three-bedroom apartment run by a lady named Mrs. Ellis. She and her husband had one bedroom, and they rented the other two out, and we shared the kitchen and bathroom. Just like that, I left home. I left Bubba's apartment one day and never came back. See, Bubba was old, and she had diabetes and couldn't control me. And it wasn't like my aunts were calling to check on me or anything like that. They had lives of their own. They didn't care about me. I was a grown child. I was no baby then. Get out there and do your own thing. That was their attitude. So I did my own thing. I moved in with Dennis, and I didn't regret it. He continued to work for my Aunt Mary while I was living with him, and she never knew it. It was a scandal, don't you think? But I did miss my mother. I missed her terribly, and I would think of her and my sister Dee Dee often. One day I had a feeling I just wanted to talk to Mama, even though I knew she didn't agree with how I was living. So I got a pile of coins together. I went outside our little room on 129th Street to a payphone and called Suffolk. Since Dennis and I lived in a room in somebody's apartment, to use the phone you had to sit in the woman's living room. I couldn't call my mother and talk Yiddish on the lady's phone. It seemed too odd to do. I was too embarrassed. So I went outside. It was a big deal to call long distance in those days. When I called, Tata picked up the line and he told me, "I don't know what you're doing up there, but your mother's sick and I need help with the store." So I came back to Suffolk. I didn't want to, but since Mama was sick, I needed to go back. I told Dennis I was going home for a few weeks, and he said he would write and send me money, which he did. When I got to Virginia, I told Tata, "I'll help out for a while, but I'm not staying." He ignored that. One of the first things he did was to take me out to Portsmouth, to one of his Jewish merchant friends, supposedly to do business, and introduced me to this man's son. He was pressing me to marry this fat guy whom I didn't even know. But I had no plans on that. I'd come home for Mama. She was growing more ill. She had become nearly blind in her left eye and would black out. She wasn't a total cripple. I mean, not even when she was ill was she truly crippled. She could cook all day and also darn socks. She could chop fish, meat, vegetables on a butcher block cutting board, all with one hand. She was a good Jewish wife who kept true to her religious faith. And she let a lot roll off her back over the years because her husband wasn't worth a dime and she had no choice. The way Tata treated her, they'd call her an abused woman today. But back then, they just called you wife. And a man could do anything he wanted to his wife in the South, especially if she's a Jew who's crippled and he's a so-called rabbi. He can yell at her, make fun of her, curse her, slap her. He can even go out with another woman right in front of her face. She tried to ignore that as long as she could, and I don't think she knew for a while because Tata was always a little strange anyway. You know, secretive. He never told us anything, like where he was born or if he had any family or relatives. Every summer he'd disappear for a few weeks to Europe. He'd say, "I'm going to see my landsman." And off he'd go on a steamer to France someplace. Landsman in Jewish is somebody from your hometown. We'd run the store in his absence, me, Dee Dee, and Mama. Till this day, I don't know exactly where he went, but a few weeks later he'd strut into the store, put down his bags, and say, "Where's my money?" We'd give it to him, and he'd sit down and count it. Even before he took off his jacket, he'd count his money. He knew just how much he was supposed to earn a week, more or less. He was serious about his money. This big, fat white lady started showing up at the store around 1939 or 1940. She had a behind as big as this living room. She lived not far from us up the road. Her husband was serving time in the county jail across the street for being drunk or some petty crime like that. She wasn't Jewish, and she had four or five kids. Tata would talk to her in the store and try to act like it was casual. Then on Friday nights, the Sabbath, Mr. Rabbi would go out. Me, Didi, and Mama would light candles and say our prayers to begin the Sabbath. And Tata would pack a bag of groceries and throw them in his car while Mama watched him. He'd say to her in Yiddish, "I'm going out." And then he'd say to me in English, "I won't be back till Monday. Open up the store Sunday morning." Then Mama would ask me, "What did he say?" "And nothing," I'd say. Their marriage was falling apart, and I was in the middle. I'd translate or not translate between them. Tata's affair became full-blown very quickly, the way I remember it. Before I knew it, he'd moved her and the kids across the North Carolina line, someplace about an hour's drive from Suffolk. He even once dragged me down there and made me wait outside the woman's house while he ran inside. He started bothering me to get Mama to give him a divorce, trying to talk to her through me. She refused, and I could understand her dilemma. She was in her early 40s then, and there was nobody to look out for her. She was handicapped. She was sick. She had no other home. She was not giving him a divorce. Never. I don't think she had one friend down in Suffolk at that time either, not that I remember. Except for her mother, she had nobody to turn to because her sisters never cared for her that much. She was just a crippled thing to them, and they rarely wrote to her and never gave her any credit for the good things she had done. Their way of being kind to her was to take me in during the summers, and by then they were done with me because I wasn't a child anymore. And here, Tata wanted to divorce her so he could marry his fat girlfriend, this woman who was bigger and taller than him, and who wasn't even Jewish. A guy. It was all so disgusting, I could hardly stand it. In order for my parents to get a divorce properly in the Jewish faith, they would have had to go to a Rav, a kind of high Jewish rabbi. But Tata didn't care for no Rav. He was done with being religious. He went out to a lawyer one day and came back with some papers and laid them on the table and told me, "Tell your mother to sign these." They were divorce papers. Mama refused. Then he went to Reno, Nevada and got himself a quickie divorce. He came back to Virginia and said, "Tell your mother we're divorced." And that was it. But nothing changed in my house. We all still lived together and we were all miserable. And by this time, I was home for a few weeks, a lot longer than I had planned, and I wanted to leave. It was a miserable time, especially for my poor sister, Didi. Didi was 4 years younger than me, only about 15 then. What a life she had. Of all of us children, Didi had the worst of it, because she was the youngest. Didi didn't seem to have problems. I always thought she was prettier than me. She wasn't rebellious like I was. We were like night and day. She was short and had curly brown hair, while I was tall and dark and thin and had a mustache. When she was little, she refused to wear hand-me-downs and wore nice skirts and socks and always looked neat, whereas I would wear hand-me-downs and look like a sack of potatoes no matter what I wore. Didi was very smart. She got good grades in school, while me and my brother Sam barely passed. She was Tata's favorite, and I was always a little jealous of her because Tata paid for her piano lessons while he wouldn't allow me to take them and that sort of thing. See, she was the first American in my family. While Sam and I were immigrants, and we had that immigrant thing on us, the kids would make fun of us for being Jewish in school. But they wouldn't make fun of Didi. You just couldn't do that to Didi. She had confidence. She was a nice Jewish girl who did what she was told. I mean, she was in high school going through the things that high school girls go through, playing tennis and learning piano. When Tata was divorcing Mama, she got lost in all that. No one ever talked to her or shared feelings with her, including me. We were close, not close enough for me to tell her the mess I had made of my life, but close enough. And one evening she came up to our bedroom and said, "I know you're going to leave, Rachel. Don't leave. Don't go back to New York." Didi was so proud, and for her to ask me to stay, well, she meant it. We didn't talk to each other that way, and for her to come out and say what she was feeling was hard for her. It hurt me so much to hear it because I couldn't stay. I'll think about it, I said. I don't believe you, she said. I know you're going back. Please don't go back. Promise me you'll stay. She sat on the bed and buried her face in her hands and cried. My little sister. Promise me, she sobbed. Promise me you'll stay. Okay, okay, I promise, I said. I'll stay. But I broke my promise to Dee Dee, and she never forgot. And she would remind me of it many years later.
Old Man Shilsky. It was November 1982, and I was tooling down Virginia State Route 460 in my green 1972 Volkswagen at 4 a.m. A few hours before, I had dropped off my ex-girlfriend Karen, a black model who renamed herself Caron, my agent told me to do it, at her grandmother's house in Petersburg. Also in tow with her was her 2-year-old son, Paul, a gentle, kind boy who seemed slightly confused as to who I was. Mommy hated Caron. You got a ready-made family now, she quipped. Your whole life was in front of you. Now look at you. What do you mean, I asked. Bye-bye dreams, she sniffed. I ignored her. Caron and I had no plans to get married. We were not close. We were both living in Boston and decided it was time to leave town, as well as each other. She was leaving her ex-husband behind. I wanted to leave myself behind. I had been working as a feature writer at the Boston Globe, a great job for a 24-year-old reporter. My best friend was a white guy about 60 years old named Ernie Santo Suoso, who was the Globe jazz critic then. We would walk around the features department singing Polka Dots and Moonbeams and It's You or No One by saxophonist Dexter Gordon. I could have stayed there with Ernie forever, dogging it and cracking jokes in the features department, but I couldn't decide whether I wanted to be a writer or a musician, not knowing that it was possible to do both. In some ways, I was caught between the worlds of black and white as well, because I discovered after college and graduate school that the earnest Change the World rap sessions me and my schoolmates had that lasted till 4 a.m. didn't change the world one iota. I can clearly remember saying to my black college roommate in my freshman year, racism is a problem that should end just about the time we graduate. Instead, it smashed me across the face like a bottle when I walked into the real world. Boston was not an easy place to have a racial identity crisis either. Its racial problems are complicated, spilling over into matters of class, history, politics, even education. It was more than I wanted to face, and I had to run. On the seat next to me was a small map of Virginia with the town of Suffolk circled on it, and a hand-drawn map Mommy had given me. It had taken years to solicit this information about where she grew up. Every time I'd ask about it, she'd say, "Oh, yeah, well, there's nobody there that remembers me." And off she went, looking for a house or chasing down some errand that lasted hours, days, or weeks. It had gotten to the point where I didn't see why she made such a secret of it. And the part of me that wanted to understand who I was began to irk and itch at me like a pesky mosquito bite that cries out to be scratched. When I finally nailed her down on it, she sat at the kitchen table, pulled out an old envelope, ripped it open, and unfolded it to give her more space. She then drew me a map of where she had lived in Suffolk. She talked as she drew. The highway goes here. Here's the bridge. The courthouse is down the road, and the Jaffe Slaughterhouse is over here. That map was the only clue I had to lead me to Mommy's family. She knew no names of people in Suffolk, despite having lived there for nearly 13 years. You can't remember anybody, I asked? Nope. Nobody? Well, I knew a girl named Frances. Who was she? She was my best friend. Where is she now? God knows. What about her family? Don't remember them, but her mother could cook like the dickens. So I went to Suffolk, looking for Frances and her mother who could cook like the dickens. Mommy didn't remember their last name. It was 7 a.m. when I arrived in town, exhausted and hungry after the drive from Petersburg. The town looked like its sugar days were over. Quiet, empty, a mix of grand old buildings and new, more of an industrial site than a town, really, with development sprawling into its surrounding areas rather than inside the town itself. I saw a McDonald's at a corner intersection. I parked there, went inside, and ordered some food. I sat down at a table and opened Mommy's little hand map. I checked the map, looked out the window, checked it again, looked out the window again. I knew I was on Main Street. There was an old courthouse building catty-corner to where I sat. Behind the courthouse was a graveyard. To my left was a bridge and a slaughterhouse. I was sitting right where her family's store used to be, 601 North Main Street. I left the food untouched and went outside and looked around. There was an old house behind the McDonald's. I knocked on the door and an elderly, bespectacled black man answered. I told him my business. Mother used to live here. Name was Shilsky, Jews, a little store. He fingered his glasses and stared at me a long time. Then he said, "Come on in here." He sat me down and bought me a soda. Then he asked me to tell my story one more time. So I did. He nodded and listened closely. Then his face broke into a smile. "That means you old Rabbi Shilsky's grandson?" "Yep." First he chuckled. Then he laughed. Then he laughed some more. He tried to control his laughing, but he couldn't, so he stopped. Took off his glasses and wiped his eyes. I started to get angry, and he apologized. His name was Eddie Thompson. He was 66. He had lived in that house all his life. It took him a minute to get himself together. "I knew your mother," he said. "We used to call her Rachel." I had never heard that name before. Even in recounting what little she had told me of her life, Mommy had never referred to herself as Rachel. She had always called herself Ruth. I discovered later that her true name was Ruhel, a Yiddish name which her family Americanized to Rachel, which she in turn further changed to an even more American-sounding Ruth. "I knew that whole family," Thompson said. "Rachel, Gladys, Sam, and the parents. Rachel was the kind-hearted one. Gladys, the young one, we called her Dee Dee. She was a little bitty thing. She looked more like the father. Sam, the brother, we used to call him Sparky. They say he got killed in World War II in a plane crash. Rachel, why, she used to walk right up and down the road here, her and the mother. The mother was crippled. She used to limp. Her whole left side was messed up. Mrs. Shilsky, what a nice lady. She'd slip you a piece of fruit or candy inside the store when the old man wasn't looking. Old man Shilsky, though..." He shrugged. "Personally, I never had a problem with him." "What was he like?" I asked, my heart pounding. Why is my heart pounding? I asked myself. I wasn't sure. "Like?" he asked. "Old man shit, my grand..." I didn't know what to call him. Neither one sounded right. "What was Shilsky like?" I asked. "Well, you being his grandson and all..." He shrugged again. "The old man was all right. I got along with him okay." I could see in his face that he didn't believe it, so I said, "You don't have to spare me. I never knew him. I'd just like to know what it was like." He cut a quick glance at the window, then said evenly, "You won't find anyone around here who liked him enough to even talk about him." "Why so?" His dislike for the colored man was very great. "How so?" "Well, he just disliked black folks. And he cheated them. Sold them anything and everything and charged them as much as he could. If you owed him $5, he'd make you pay back 10. He shot old Lijah Ricks in the stomach. Lijah brought that on himself, though. Went in the Shilsky store fussing over some sardines and crackers and wouldn't pay. So Shilsky shot him in the left or right side, I can't remember which. He didn't kill him, but he was a hateful one, old man Shilsky. His own wife was scared of him." "How do you know all this?" "No? Why, I could practically see into the man's house from my bedroom. We were right next door. I worked for Shilsky at one time. Made 10 cents a day firing up his stove on Saturday mornings, 'cause Jews can't do much on Saturday. That's their Sunday, you see. He had a kerosene stove that left black marks everywhere. I wonder what happened to it." He pondered it a minute before I brought him back to the subject at hand. "He had a good thing there," Eddie Thompson said, "making money hand over fist off the Negro. But see, he was mean as a dog. Mrs. Shilsky was terrified of the old man. If she was talking to you and he came into the room, she'd shush up and tremble." I listened in silence, his words landing on me like bricks. "What happened to him?" I asked. "He run off with one of the sorriest, trashiest, poorest Job's turkey white woman you ever did see. I don't know how he got mixed up with her. She was a Claxton, Richard Claxton's wife. The old man, he fell in love with her because of Mrs. Shilsky's being like she was, I reckon. That woman was big as a house. He looked like a boy when he walked down the road next to her. He was a little bitty guy. He laughed, bittersweet. Old man Shilsky, boy, he was something else. You have any idea where he went? Nope. Maybe Richmond. Don't know for sure. I'd sure like to find him, I said. Oh, I know where you can find him, the old man said. He pointed down to the ground and winked. They'd let him in down there even if the bridge was out. They'd parachute him over. He talked for a long time, chuckling, disbelieving. Rachel just left one day. I'm telling you, she left, and we thought she was dead. That whole family is long gone. We didn't think we'd ever see none of them again till we got to the other side. And now you pop up. Lord knows it's a great day. He asked if he could call Mommy. I picked up the phone and dialed Mommy's house long distance, got her on the phone, and told her I had somebody who wanted to talk to her. I handed the phone to him. Rachel? Yeah. Rachel. This is Eddie Thompson. From down in Suffolk. Remember me? We used to live right back... Yeah, that's right. Pause. No. Everybody's dead now but Molly, Helen, Margaret, and Edward. That's right. Well, I'll be. The Lord touched me today. He paused a moment, listening. Rachel? That ain't you crying now, is it? This is old Eddie Thompson. You remember me? Don't cry now.
A Bird Who Flies. In the summer of 1941, before I came back to New York to stay with Dennis in Harlem, we received a letter in Suffolk from Mama's family in New York. It said, "We have 3 rooms worth of furniture. Do you want it?" Bubba lived in a 3-room apartment. That's how they told us Bubba was dead. They didn't even bother to write to Mama, but rather wrote to Tata in English, which Mama didn't read nor understand. Tata read the letter and tossed it to me. "Read this to your mother," he said, and walked away. I waited till evening to read it to her, which meant she was walking around the store all day not knowing her mother was dead. And Tata knew it, and I knew it, and it was just a mess. I read it to her in her bedroom, the one she shared with me and Dee Dee. She had a little rocking chair that she sat in, and she was sitting there looking out the window when I came into the room. I said, "Mama, I have something to read to you." And I read it to her. She never said a word. She just sat there and stared into the night, tears rolling down her face. Not a sound from her lips, not one word. Later on, I went to bed, and I heard a little noise coming from her bed. She slept in a little bed by herself, and I heard this little noise coming from her bed, and I knew she was crying, and I said, "It's all right, Mama, it's all right." But she just cried and cried, just weeping. I can still hear her weeping now sometimes. I know the exact sound of it, like a note you hear or a song that keeps spinning around in your head and you can't forget it. Every once in a while when I'm walking down the street and I think I hear it, just a quick sniffle noise, like a, oh, and I turn around and there's no one there. I stuck around Suffolk a while longer, and then I left for good sometime in 1941. I can't remember the exact time of all this because it was a bad time. It was bad. I left over Mama's objections, too. She said, "You can have a good life here." But I said, "I can't live here, Mama." And she didn't bring it up ever again or ask me to stay any longer. There was no life in Suffolk for me. I packed what few things I wanted and tried to talk to Dee Dee before I left. But she wouldn't talk to me. "You promised me you wouldn't go," she said, and she walked away from me. As I left the store to walk downtown to the bus station, Mama handed me a bag lunch and kissed me, and I was out the door and gone. I never saw her or Dee Dee ever again. Tata didn't say a word to me as I walked out. The Greyhound bus station was across from the Suffolk Hotel in those days, and I was standing there waiting for the bus to come when Tata pulled up his car. He kept a big V8 Ford. He got out, and he took his hands out of his pockets and started pacing. He said, "You should stay." I said, "I can't." I was nervous. He always made me nervous. "I'll get you a route," he said. "You can have your own route, selling supplies to farmers in the country. You'll make a bundle. Or you can get a job in Norfolk. You can move there." I said, "No." "You want to go to college? I'll send you to college in Norfolk. Or business school, whatever you want, but you got to stay." "I can't do that." "I'm telling you to stay," he said. "You hear me? I need you to run the store, and your mother needs you." I began to yell at him, and we argued. Here he was, having divorced Mama, and he was still using her against me. Then he said, "I know you're going to marry a Schwarzer. You're making a mistake." That stopped me cold because I didn't know how he learned it. Till this day, I don't know. He said, "If you marry a nigger, don't you ever come home again. Don't come back. I'll always come to see Mama." "Not if you marry a nigger, you won't," he said. "Don't come back." He got in his car and he left. When the bus came, I got on it and I cried a little and then fell asleep. When I woke later on, I opened the lunch bag Mama had packed for me, and inside, tucked between the knishes and the matzo balls and chopped liver, was her Polish passport with her picture inside. It's the only picture I have of her. She's sitting down holding me and my brother Sam in her lap. A few weeks after I got back to New York and was living with Dennis in Harlem, Dennis overheard my Aunt Mary say that Tata had put out a detective to look for me. It just made me lay low in Harlem. I was never going back home. Instead, I got a job at a glass factory down in the Chelsea area of Manhattan. My job was to hold these glass tubes over fire and stretch them into test tubes. I would come home from work every night with big burns on my hands. Not long after, in early 42, Dennis came home from Aunt Mary's factory and told me he heard Aunt Mary say that my mother was sick and had been brought up to a hospital in the Bronx. I right away went out and called Aunt Mary and asked her if she knew where Mama was. She said, "You're out of the family. Stay out. We sat shiver for you. You can't see her." Well, that just hurt me to the bone. And that night I told Dennis, "I've got to see her." He said, "Ruth, your Aunt Mary made it clear that you're not welcome up there." That gave me pause. I didn't want to make Mama sicker. After all, I was out of the family. I worried sick about it. I tried to think what to do, but I could not decide. A few days later, I was at work at the glass factory, and the foreman, a German man, came over to me and told me I had a phone call. It was Dennis. He was calling from Aunt Mary's factory. He told me Mama had just passed away. They had a locker room in the glass factory where we changed and put on our work aprons, and I hung up the phone and went in there and howled out my grief. The foreman and other workers came in there and tried to help me stand because I had fallen to the floor, but I couldn't get up. I tried to, but I couldn't. And one of the ladies was saying, "Oh, she don't have to act like that, hollering and carrying on." I was depressed for months. I lost weight, I couldn't eat, and I was near suicide. And I kept saying, why couldn't it have been me that died? I would go on long walks and forget where I was. I'd be someplace and I couldn't remember how I got there. Dennis was the one who shook me out of it. He kept saying, "You've got to forgive yourself, Ruth. God forgives you. He'll forgive the most dreaded sin, the most dreaded sin." But I couldn't listen, not for a long while. I couldn't listen. I was so sorry deep in my heart. I was sorry. But all your sorries are gone when a person dies. She was gone. Gone. That's why you have to say all your sorries and I love yous while a person is living. Because tomorrow isn't promised. Lord, I was burning with hurt. I hung on to Mama's passport and carried it everywhere. I didn't think she was dying when I left home, but she knew it. That's why she gave me that passport. I've always held that to this day, that guilt that I left Mama because all her life I was the one who translated for her and helped her around. I was her eyes and ears in America. And when I left, well, Santa had gone and Bubba had died. And her husband treated her so bad and divorced her, and her reasons for living had just slipped away. It was a bad time. It took me a long time to get over it, but Dennis stuck it out with me. And after a while, I began to listen to what he said about God forgiving you, and I began to hold on to that, that God will forgive you, will forgive the most dreaded sin, because I felt Mama deserved better from me. And that's when I started going to Metropolitan Church in Harlem with Dennis to hear Reverend Brown preach. It helped me to hear the Christian way because I needed help. I needed to let Mama go. And that's when I started to become a Christian, and the Jew in me began to die. The Jew in me was dying anyway, but it truly died when my mother died. I remembered how she used to laugh when she waved chickens over our heads on Yom Kippur. I'll bet they don't even do that now. She'd wave a live chicken over her head and say to the chicken, "You to death, me to life." And we'd scream and run away because my father would take the chicken from her and kill it as a blood sacrifice. I didn't like that. It seemed so old-fashioned and odd. "I don't want to do that in America," I'd say. But she'd say, "That chicken is just showing God we're thankful for living. It's just a chicken. It's not a bird who flies. A bird who flies is special. You would never trap a bird who flies." She used to sit in a little rocking chair in her room upstairs and watch the birds. She'd lay crumbs on the ledge of her window, and the birds would gather there and eat while she sang to them. But she'd always shoo them away and make them fly off so they'd be free again. She had a little Yiddish song she used to sing to them. "Fegele, fegele, geh weg. Birdie, birdie, fly away."
A Jew discovered. It was afternoon, August 1992, and I was standing in front of the only synagogue in downtown Suffolk, a collection of old storefronts, dimly lit buildings, and old railroad tracks that tell of better, more populous times. It's a small, old white building with four tall columns and a row of stairs leading to a tall doorway. This is the synagogue that young Rachel Shilsky walked to with her family, and where Rabbi Shilsky led the congregation during the Jewish holidays Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, and Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement and Fasting. When I was a boy, Jewish holidays meant a day off from school for me, and that was it. I certainly had no idea they had anything to do with me. I felt like an oddball standing in front of the quiet, empty building, and I looked up and down the street every couple of minutes, lest the cops come by and wonder why a black man was loitering in front of a white man's building in the middle of the day in Suffolk, Virginia. This is, after all, the 90s, and any black man who loiters in front of a building for a long time looking it over is bound to draw suspicion from cops and others who probably think he's looking for an open entrance so he can climb in and steal something. Black males are closely associated with crime in America, not with white Jewish mothers, and I could not imagine a police officer buying my story as I stood in front of the Jewish temple saying, "Yeah, my grandfather was the rabbi here, you know." The sun was baking the sidewalk, and it was so hot, I sat down on the steps, placing my tape recorder and notebook next to me. My long search for the Shilsky family ended here. I had spent considerable time looking through school records, court records, and other documents with mixed results. My grandmother Hudis was buried far from here, in a Long Island graveyard amongst hundreds and hundreds of Jews, more than she ever had the pleasure of living around down here. The U.S. Army forked over the death record of Sergeant Sam Shilsky, who died in February 1944, but the details of his service record were gone forever, lost in a fire of Army personnel records. I felt like I was stalking ghosts. No sign of Reverend Shilsky, whom I traced to a Brooklyn address in the 1960s, where he apparently landed after wandering through Norfolk, Virginia, Belleville, New Jersey, and Manhattan. Dee Dee vanished from Suffolk shortly before her mother died and never returned. She withdrew from Suffolk High on January 23, 1942, one semester short of graduation. Her mother died 5 days later on January 28, 1942, in New York City. I could only imagine how painful that must have been, having to leave the only real home she ever had at age 17, her mother gone, her father with a Gentile woman, her brother in the war, her sister disappeared, being completely helpless as the pillars of her life fell away like toothpicks. Everything she had known was gone. Whom did she live with? Maybe her father kept her. Who knows? I had a feeling she was still alive. She would have been about 67 then. I could have tracked her down. I was, after all, a reporter. But after a couple of feeble attempts, I gave up. I didn't have the heart. I didn't want to introduce any more pain into her life. She had seen enough. The closest I could come to her was to sit on these synagogue steps, baking in the August heat, and wonder. I wanted to see the inside of the synagogue. I wanted to see it, then later tell my black wife and two children about it, because some of my blood runs through there, because my family has a history there, because there's a part of me in there, whether I or those that run the synagogue like it or not. In truth, I had never been inside an actual synagogue before, the closest being the time I was working as a reporter and did a story about a Jewish school in Queens that had a synagogue attached to it. In the course of interviewing the headmaster, a woman, I mentioned that my mother was Jewish, and she exclaimed, "Well, according to Jewish law, that means you're Jewish, too. We have a black Jew who works in our school." She hit the intercom button on her desk and said, "Sam, can you come up here a minute?" Minutes later, the black janitor walked in, holding a mop, smiling. I'd pay good money for a picture of my face at that moment. Old Sam smiled and said hello, and I gurgled out a polite response, though I wanted to choke myself for opening up my big mouth. When I called the rabbi of my mother's old synagogue, he spoke to me with neither nostalgia nor surprise, only grudging recognition. He had heard I was in town from other Jews whom I had met. He knew I was black, and he knew who my mother was. "I remember your mother," he said. I explained to him that I was writing a book about my family and asked if I might see some of the synagogue records. "There is nothing in them that would help you," he said curtly. I asked if I could see the inside of the synagogue itself. He said, "I'll have to check with some other board members to see who would have time to open it up and let you see it," and hung up. I knew the deal. Given the photo of the board members on the synagogue's anniversary pamphlet I had obtained, I doubted if half the old geezers on the board were still drawing air. I hung up, muttering to myself, "I didn't want to see your silly old synagogue anyway." By then, I had seen enough anyway. The smell of azaleas and the creeping loneliness that climbed over me as I poked around Suffolk had begun to suffocate me. The isolation my family had felt, the heartbreak they had suffered, seemed to ooze out of the trees, curling through the stately old brick buildings and rising like steam off the Civil War statue that seemed to point its cannon directly at me as I wandered through the town graveyard. I wanted to leave right at that moment, but instead sat on the synagogue steps as if glued, as my mind reeled back to the previous trip in 1982, when fate and luck led me deep into the bowels of a state office building where Aubrey Rubenstein was working for the Highway Department right-of-way office. Rubenstein was in his early 60s then, a heavy-set man with dark hair, a deep southern accent, and a very clear and concise manner. His father had taken over my grandfather's store around 1942 after the old man left town. When I walked into his office and explained who I was, he looked at me a long, long time. He didn't smile. He didn't frown. Finally, he spoke. "What a surprise," he said softly. He offered me a seat and a cup of coffee. I accepted. "Don't move from there," he said. He got on the phone. "Jaffe," he said, "I have incredible news. Sam Shilsky's grandson is here." "Sitting in my office?" "No kidding." "Mm-hmm. And you won't believe it. He's black." "No, I'm not lying. He's a reporter writing a book about his family." "Yep." When he hung up the phone, he said, "When we're done, go around to the slaughterhouse on Main and see Jared Jaffe and his family. They'd like to see you in person." I knew the name Jaffe. Mommy had spoken of them several times. The Jaffes had a slaughterhouse down the road. Tata would take us there to slaughter the cows in the kosher faith. I made a point to go see them. Like most of the Jews in Suffolk, he treated me very kindly, truly warm and welcoming, as if I were one of them, which, in an odd way, I suppose I was. I found it odd and amazing when white people treated me that way, as if there were no barriers between us. It said a lot about this religion, Judaism, that some of its followers, old Southern crackers who talked with Southern twangs and wore straw hats, seemed to believe that its covenants went beyond the color of one's skin. The Sheffers, Helen Weintraub, the Jaffes, they talked to me in person and by letter in a manner and tone that, in essence, said, "Don't forget us. We have survived here. Your mother was part of this." Sitting in his office, Aubrey Rubinstein talked easily, as a black colleague sat nearby eavesdropping with awe at the macabre conversation that unfolded between this elderly white man and myself. "There are not that many of us left," Aubrey said. "We had maybe 25 or 30 Jewish families here at one time, back when your grandfather was around. The older ones died, the younger ones left. Some went to California, some to Virginia Beach, or just moved. The only ones who stayed had businesses with their fathers that dropped down to them." "Why did they all leave?" I asked. "Why stay?" he said. "It was not that easy a place for a Jew to live. It was a tiny population of Jews. Most were merchants of one type or another. I suppose some found it easier to make a living elsewhere. Wandering Jews, I thought." We spoke easily for quite a while. "It's an interesting thing that you come down to check on your granddaddy," he said. "It's quite a story, I must say." I asked him about my family. "Well, it was kind of a tragedy, really. Shilsky wasn't the man he could have been. He was a good rabbi. By that, I mean he knew what he was teaching. In fact, he taught me a little as a boy. But he went into business full-time, which didn't please a lot of Jews here, and he was seeing another woman for years. I'm not sure whether he was divorced when he left here or not, but I ran into him in New York after the war, maybe 46. Me and another fella went to see him about buying the piece of property next door to his store. He was up in Brooklyn." "What was he doing there?" "I don't know. But I believe Mrs. Shilsky had died by then. The whole thing was very tragic." Seeing the expression on my face, he added, "Your grandmother was a fine lady. I still remember her coming to temple, lighting the candles and standing up to say her prayers. I remember her clearly. She was crippled in the leg. She was a very fine lady." I asked him if anyone knew how Rabbi Shilsky treated his family, and Rubinstein shrugged. "There are things that you hear, but no one asked. He was tight with his money, and they could have been doing better than they looked. The Shilskys kept to themselves. Your Uncle Sam, he joined the Air Force and got killed in a plane crash in Alaska. They didn't find his body or that of the other pilot for a long time, if they ever did find them. I heard this and don't know it to be true or not. Your Aunt Gladys, you don't know her, do you? She was a very bright girl. Your mother, well, she was a fine girl. Of course, we had heard rumors, and I'm being frank, that she had run off and married a black man, but I never knew it to be true or not. My daddy at one time said it, but my parents never gave it any further comment. My father and mother were like, liberals in their days. I never heard them knock anybody for being white or black or green or Christian or Jew or Catholic." I said nothing, listening in silence. I imagined that the news of Mommy's marriage crashed through the Jewish community like an earthquake. "How is your mother?" he asked. "Fine." "You know," he said, fingering the papers on his desk, "you look a little bit like your mother. The smile. Do you attend temple, being part Jewish?" "No, she didn't raise us Jewish." "Well, maybe that was for the best," he said. I was surprised by his candidness and said so. We talked for a while longer before I rose to go. "Next time you come back, I'll see if I can dig up a picture of that old store," he said. "Make sure to tell your mother Aubrey Rubinstein said hello." I pointed to my tape player on his desk. "The tape is running," I said. "You can say it yourself." He leaned over to the tape and spoke into it softly. When he was done, he leaned back in his chair and looked at the ceiling thoughtfully. She picked that life for herself, and she lived it. That's all. What her reasons for it were, I don't know. But she did a good job. She raised 12 children. She led a good life. I told him I'd be back in a few months. I'll have a picture of that store for you, he promised. But I waited 10 years to come back, and when I called on him again, he had died. I kept the tape with his greeting to Mommy on it for years, and while I never played it for her, thinking it might be too emotional for her to hear it, I played it for myself many times, thinking, wishing, hoping that the world would be this open-minded, knowing that God is. Ruth, this is Aubrey Rubenstein. I don't know if you remember me or not, but if you do, I'm glad to meet your son, and I see you've accomplished a great deal in your life. If you're ever down this way, stop on by and say hello to us. We all remember you. We wish you the best. As I sat on the steps of the synagogue in the hot August sun, his words sliced through my memory like raindrops. I watched as two little black girls strode by, waved, and walked on. One was eating a bag of potato chips. I said to myself, whatever I'm looking for, I've found it. I got in my car and drove back to the McDonald's where the store had been. I walked around the grounds once again as if the earth would speak to me, but it did not. It was just a cement parking lot. They ought to take the whole kit and caboodle of these cement parking lots and heave them into the sea, I thought. The Shilskis were gone. Long gone. That night, I slept in a motel just down the road from the McDonald's, and at about 4 a.m, I sat straight up. Something just drew me awake. I tossed and turned for an hour, then got dressed and went outside, walking down the road toward the nearby wharf. As I walked along the wharf and looked over the Nansemond River, which was colored an odd purple by the light of the moon, I said to myself, what am I doing here? This place is so lonely. I gotta get out of here. It suddenly occurred to me that my grandmother had walked around here and gazed upon this water many times, and the loneliness and agony that Hudis Shilsky felt as a Jew in this lonely southern town, far from her mother and sisters in New York, unable to speak English, a disabled Polish immigrant whose husband had no love for her and whose dreams of seeing her children grow up in America vanished as her life drained out of her at the age of 46, suddenly rose up in my blood and washed over me in waves. A penetrating loneliness covered me, lay on me so heavily I had to sit down and cover my face. I had no tears to shed. They were done long ago, but a new pain and a new awareness were born inside me. The uncertainty that lived inside me began to dissipate. The ache that the little boy who stared in the mirror felt was gone. My own humanity was awakened, rising up to greet me with a handshake as I watched the first glimmers of sunlight peek over the horizon. There's such a big difference between being dead and alive, I told myself. And the greatest gift that anyone can give anyone else is life. And the greatest sin a person can do to another is to take away that life. Next to that, all the rules and religions in the world are secondary, mere words and beliefs that people choose to believe and kill and hate by. My life won't be lived that way, and neither, I hope, will my children's. I left for New York happy in the knowledge that my grandmother had not suffered and died for nothing.
Dennis. In 1942, Dennis and I were living in a room in the Port Royal on 129th Street between 7th and 8th Avenues. And one night after work, I walked into the hallway of our building, and this black woman punched me right in the face. She hit me so hard, I fell to the floor. "Don't disrespect me," she said. She was a raving lunatic. I never knew who she was. I somehow got off the floor, and she chased me up to our room, and I slammed the door on her and waited for my husband to get home. Dennis went to speak to her when he got home from work. "That white woman doesn't belong here," she said. That's what she told him. Dennis didn't attack her. He just said, "Leave my wife alone," And she did. Even though we were not married, we considered ourselves husband and wife. Some black folks never did accept me. Most did. But there were always a few running around saying Nubian this and Nubian that, and always talking about Africa and all this. Well, I'm the mother of black children, and nobody will ever deny me my children, and they can put that in their Nubian pipe and smoke it. All this Nubian. If you want to go back to Africa, James, well, you can go. I don't see the point in your going when you have a family here, but if you feel you want to go to Africa to find your roots, I won't stop you. I'll still be your mother when you come back, and you'll still be my son. There was no turning back after my mother died. I stayed on the black side because that was the only place I could stay. The few problems I had with black folks was nothing compared to the grief white folks dished out. With whites, it was no question. You weren't accepted to be with a black man, and that was that. They'd say, forget it. Are you crazy? A nigger? And you? No way. They called you white trash. That's what they called me. Nowadays, these mixed couples get on TV every other day complaining, oh, it's so hard for us. They have cars and televisions and homes, and they're complaining. Jungle fever, they call it, flapping their jaws and making the whole thing sound stupid. They didn't have to run for their lives like we did. Me and Dennis caused a riot on 105th Street once. A bunch of white men chased us up the street and surrounded Dennis and tried to kill him, throwing bottles and hitting and kicking him until one of them made the rest of them stop. He said, get out of here while you can, and we ran for it. See, most interracial marriages did not last. That's what Dennis would say when we'd argue. I'm saying, I'm leaving. And he'd say, go ahead, go ahead. That's what people want us to do. That's what they expect. And he was right. See, a marriage needs love and God and a little money. That's all. The rest you can deal with. It's not about black or white. It's about God, and don't let anyone tell you different. All this jungle fever. Shoot. That jungle fever goes away, honey. And then what are you going to do? I say that now in hindsight because Dennis was afraid to marry me at first. We were acting as husband and wife and having so much fun, I didn't care that we weren't married. Our little room on 129th off 7th was smack dab in the middle of all the action in Harlem. There were parades and dignitaries marching up and down 7th Avenue back in those days. Adam Clayton Powell used to stand on a podium right on 125th Street and make political speeches. Malcolm X, too. On Saturdays, we'd go to the Apollo Theater, and if you get there by 11 a.m., you could sit there all day through three shows. They'd start with newsreels on the war, comedy shorts, cartoons, and sometimes a movie western with Hoots Tebbekon, or a musical with Jeanette MacDonald and Nelson Eddy. Then at 1 p.m., they played the Apollo theme song, I Think You're Wonderful, and the bands would bust loose, Count Basie, Duke Ellington, Jimmy Lunsford, Louis Jordan, Billie Holiday, and Billy Eckstein. Those musicians worked like slaves, three shows a day. Then on Sunday, we go to the Metropolitan Baptist Church on 128th and Lenox Avenue to hear Reverend Abner Brown preach. That man was the finest preacher I ever heard to this day. He could make a frog stand up straight and get happy with Jesus. You never heard anything like him. He was not fire and brimstone. He brought God into your everyday life in a way that made you think heaven was right next door. Harlem loved him. Metropolitan was the church in Harlem back then. Abyssinian was a big church, too, but they'd line up along 128th Street to get into Metropolitan like it was a rock concert. If you didn't get out on that sidewalk by 9 a.m. on Sunday morning for the 11 a.m. service, you had to stand in the aisles, and the place seated maybe, I don't know, at least 2,000 people. They'd hold two services at the same time, one in the big church upstairs and one downstairs. That's how crowded it was. Dennis was a deacon, and he sang in the church choir, and it was a mighty, mighty choir, too. What a time it was. Those were my glory days. My world expanded because of Dennis. He taught me about things I'd never heard of. He meditated every day for 15 minutes. He did that for years, so that even the children learned to accept the ritual. He believed in equal rights, in knowledge in books. He taught me about people like Paul Robeson, Paul Lawrence Dunbar, and Joe Louis. He loved the Brooklyn Dodgers, Don Newcomb, Roy Campanella, and Jackie Robinson, especially Jackie Robinson. He couldn't stop talking about him. Jackie Robinson proved the Negro can play, he said. I learned how to eat my main meal in the evening instead of in the afternoon. Instead of eating kosher, different table settings for every meal, and eating all meat or all dairy dishes, I just ate what I wanted. I tasted pork chops and loved them. Grits, eggs, biscuits, butter, bacon, collard greens, ham hocks, and all the food I couldn't eat before. I ate. But see, I couldn't iron or clean house or cook. I had never learned to cook as a girl. I worked in the store all day while Mama cooked kosher, and Tata would hire a black lady to come in twice a week to help Mama cook. My husband cooked better than I did. And when I stayed home after our first baby, I had to learn to cook from my black friends, Susie Belton and Irene Johnson. Susie Belton and her husband, Edward, had a room right next to ours in Harlem, and Susie's room was always spotless, with curtains and lace across the window and bed, whereas my place always looked like thunder hit it. In 1942, a few months after my mother died, I told Dennis, I want to accept Jesus Christ into my life and join the church. Dennis said, are you sure you want to do this, Ruth? You know what this means? I told him, I'm sure. I was totally sure. A few Sundays later, we were at Metropolitan, and they were singing, I Must Tell Jesus. And the Spirit filled me, and when Reverend Abner Brown asked if anyone wanted to join Metropolitan in Christian fellowship, I stepped into the aisle and walked to the front of the church. Reverend Brown shook my hand, and all the deacons shook my hand, and I have never turned back since. I accepted Jesus that day, and he never let me down from that day to this. I later got on as the church secretary, typing out letters for Reverend Brown and sometimes witnessing weddings, which he held in his office, because I'd been the only one around and you needed two witnesses for a wedding. Watching all these weddings made me long for my own. Here I was, a church secretary, and Dennis was a stout deacon, and we weren't even married. That was a scandal I couldn't live with. I told Dennis one night, we have to get married. But he was hesitant. He said, I grew up in the South, and I can be killed down there for marrying a woman of another race. And I said, this isn't the South. This is New York, and I'm a new Christian before God, and I'm not living in sin anymore. I told him I was leaving if we didn't get married. That tied him up. He hemmed and hawed so long, I actually went out and put a deposit on a room. And when I did that, he said, you don't have to do that, Ruth. I love you, and I'd like you to marry me if you would. What a man he was. I loved him. He was the kindest man I've ever known. All his friends from North Carolina who lived in Harlem would come see him. They'd holler up to our window, Dennis, Dennis! And he'd invite them in and give him our last food or the shirt off his back if they asked. He came from a home where kindness was a way of life. I wanted to be in this kind of family. I was proud to join it, and they were happy to have me. We had to meet at City Hall to get our marriage license on a Saturday because we both worked during the week. Dennis had to work that Saturday morning also. He had quit my Aunt Mary's by then and was working for the McCoy Publishing Company, a mail-order business that supplied emblems, aprons, and books to the Masonic Order. We arranged to meet in front of City Hall at 2 o'clock. I was there at 2 on the dot, and I waited about an hour. And just as I started to walk away thinking I thought so, he appeared. You won't get rid of me that easy, he said. There are a lot of stares and whispering and pointing and silly questions. When we went to the marriage bureau to get our license, the clerks were very nasty and no one wanted to write up our paperwork. But we didn't let those fools ruin our marriage. We got the license and Reverend Brown married us in his private office at the church. I had told him the truth about me and Dennis not really being married, and he said, don't worry, I'll marry you, and be quiet about it. It wasn't until later I discovered several church members had lived together for years as husband and wife and had never gotten married. Some even had grown kids, and Reverend Brown had married them all after the fact. So this was nothing new to him.